We are going to talk about the first part of the book of Genesis. So we'll go through the first 11 chapters, and that's got some of the really interesting things in it. The idea, the whole point of doing this series is to dive into the idea of origins. Where did we come from? We talked in our last lesson that every civilization that's ever been anywhere on earth has had a fascination with how did this world get here? Where did we come from, and what does this mean? Is there meaning in our life? And it's hard to get away from that question. So in our last lesson, we began with Genesis 1. I won't reread this, but this is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness hovered over the deep, and the Spirit of God was there in the darkness. And what you see, and I'll repeat this again, but in the first 3 days, there's 6 days of creation, in the first 3 days, what you see God doing is bringing order out of chaos. He says, let there be light, and there was light, and it separated the light and the dark. And you'll see a separating of the waters and a separating of land and water, ordering, making sense out of chaos. The next 3 days, which will be the focus of what we're talking about in this lesson, you see God filling the void with content, with meaning. So bringing order out of chaos and putting meaning into the void is one of the fundamental foundational ideas of Genesis creation. So we talked about the creation of the universe. And I want to recap that briefly and pick up a couple of things that I didn't talk about that I think will be helpful to answer some of your questions. So we summarized, it's popular to think of you can believe in the Bible or you can believe science. And I think that's a false dichotomy. I don't think that's true. I think science done well fits very nicely. And I don't mean fits as in we merge the Bible into the current theory. I just mean doing science is a humble project, and I think it fits very well. Christians, more and more Christians are at the top echelon. I see this in my work with a lot of Christians who are in the top echelons of research and academia around the world, and Christians should be great scientists. So one of the things is, what does science have to say about creation? So creation of the universe, the Bible basically says God spoke the universe into existence from nothing. Well, there are three scientific theories in my lifetime. So in the past decades, there have been three different theories. That's not a bad thing. That's the way science should work. Science never assumes that a theory is true. It's just so far the best fit for what has been observed. And sure enough, it changes. Up until the mid-60s, the theory, every reputable physicist in the world believed in the steady state theory of the universe, meaning the universe has always been around, it's always going to be around. Mid-60s, that changed, and you get the Big Bang. And that's the idea that the universe had a beginning. Now, they don't know how the mass got there, the matter got there, but it was all compressed together and it blew up. It's like having too many toddlers in a room, bad things happen. You know, just get them too close together, it blows up. That's what happened. And then recently, and kind of coming on, is the multiverse theory. Multiverse theory is the idea that there are actually, and usually, an infinite number of universes. And I'll explain to you where these come from in just a second. So the Big Bang theory, all these scientific theories, by the way, have to answer this question. And I know it sounds trivial, but this is what science is trying to answer. Why is there something rather than nothing? Does that make sense? What's in space? Have you ever thought about what's in between the matter? A whole lot of nothingness. You could put some nice words on it, but we have no idea what's in between things. We have no idea what fills space. And so the question becomes, why is there something rather than nothing? And so these theories are attempting to fundamentally explore that question. Big Bang theory comes along, and the Big Bang theory assumes, and all of the scientific theories assume, that there's nothing beyond the natural world. It's an assumption, it's baked in, it's a limitation of the scientific approach. It's just part of science to assume that there's nothing supernatural, nothing beyond natural, which means no God. You cannot assume that there's a God. Bible does, and so consequently, you're going to see them go in different directions. Big Bang Theory was somewhat satisfying. Scientists didn't like that you had a beginning because that sounded a lot like Genesis. Seriously, never been happy with this theory. And so the question then becomes about, as you look at the universe, so of course you have a universe that's 14 billion years old, big explosion, takes a long time to form galaxies and planets and all that sort of thing. So you have this really, really, really old Earth by you almost have to have in that theory. The problem with that theory is the universe is so finely tuned to work. I mean, the odds of this mass exploding and it not just imploding, or it explodes and expands so fast, a planet never forms. There are, I think I told you, as many as 300 constants. I work with 34 physical constants, meaning they're finely tuned so that in this universe, if the gravitational force were stronger, you wouldn't have planets. And if it were weaker, you wouldn't have the galaxies. In other words, it's finely tuned. Well, that's a problem, because if you have random things happening like an explosion, how likely is it that it's just going to be perfectly designed, perfectly tuned to exist the way it does? That's a real problem. Multiverse gets around that problem. The multiverse is popular for this very reason, and that is, I don't just have one universe, I've got an infinite number of universes. And so I might say, hey, how do you deal with the idea that this universe is finely tuned? They go, well, this one is. I'll bet the other ones aren't. Right? And so multiverse gets you around. I know this sounds trivial. This is it. This is it. It gets you around that problem. So you'll see scientific theories move to deal with certain problems and certain thorny issues. So that brought us to the idea of a young Earth and old Earth. This is recap. I just want to hit some things that your questions highlighted that I didn't talk about. So if you believe that the Genesis account is talking about six 24-hour days, and you add up time frames in the Bible from genealogies and so forth, then you would look and you would say the Earth is somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 years old. The one thing I would say is this requires that you believe in God. It requires that you believe that Genesis is very, I hate to use the word literal, but that you read Genesis with the literal sense of the terms, okay? The old Earth says that the Earth was created over a long time, the universe actually, is created over about 14 billion years. You can be an atheist. In fact, all atheists hold this position, but you could also be a theist and hold this position. There are people who believe in God and also think that this is an old Earth, or the universe is very old. The atheists don't care about reconciling this with Genesis 1, but people that believe in God say that the days in Genesis 1, maybe those were really long periods of time. Okay, so the argument between Christians who think the Earth, the universe is young, or the universe is old, is not really about whether God did it. Question is, how did God go about doing it? Did God choose to use these processes, these natural means and natural processes? Atheists look at it and say that based on the observable age of things and the theory that we have, the Earth and the universe needs to be about 14 billion years old. And I really want you to get your head around this. It's going to sound anti-science, but it's not. I just want you to know what people don't tell you about this, and that is none of this is as certain as you've been told. And good scientists will tell you none of this is as certain as you've been told. The idea that the universe is that old isn't because anybody measured it. It's because this theory requires it. And so time will come when we'll find measurements that may or may not agree with that, in which case this will change. The key to a lot of the questions that you had were about dating. So even if you don't think the universe is 14 billion years old, one of the things that your several of your questions were about, but wait a minute, don't we have evidence that there are things that we've dug up that are older than 6,000 to 10,000 years? Don't we have evidence that dinosaurs lived millions of years ago? So I want to talk about that a little bit. I want to talk about dating methods. And I want to talk to you about how do we come up with those kinds of dates. So current thinking in the scientific community is humans probably, and again, defining human is not trivial. If you're an evolutionist, which we're going to get into evolution here in a minute, is it's very hard to know in an evolutionary point when do you get a human. If you assume that you start with small organisms and they become more and more complex, and then at some point it becomes human. At what point does it become human? We'll talk about that more. But basically, humans showed up around 280,000 to 350,000 years ago. Dinosaurs, 66 million to 285 million years ago, that they lived in that general range, in that general era. So how would you know that? Where did we even get these numbers? How would you measure that? Because you don't actually have anything that can measure that, per se. But I just want to go through this with you so that you will just, I want to help us be informed about how do you date these things in science. The first and the most popular is radiocarbon dating, carbon-14 dating. Carbon-14 dating is only on organic materials. So like, for example, at Museum of the Bible, when you have parchment, which is leather that was written on, you'll do carbon dating on that leather. You can't tell when it was written, but you can tell roughly when that animal died. That makes sense. You could tell when the animal lived. I don't know when it was written, but it was definitely written after the animal died. So radiocarbon dating is for basically organic material, papyrus, old paper, or made from plants. You can radiocarbon date those. Radiocarbon dating has a limitation of about 50,000 years old. So you're not going to get a dinosaur bone and radiocarbon date it. Just doesn't happen. Right? So you will find some traces of carbon in it, which is interesting, but that's a rabbit trail I don't want to go down. But approximately back to approximately 50,000 years old. But there are assumptions in radiocarbon dating. In fact, there are assumptions in everything in science. I told you that the theories of the universe assumes there's nothing but natural causes. That may be true, may be untrue, but if that assumption is wrong, your theories are going to be wrong. Every one of these dating methods have assumptions in them, and that's not bad. That's the way science works. Radiocarbon dating isn't actually, there are actually times when you know you can't carbon date something. There are documents, there's a period of time in history where we know that you can't date a document in that time period. Because one of the assumptions, this has to do with how much carbon was in the atmosphere over time. Does that make sense? And so then you can tell how much that creature ingested, and depending how much that creature ingested, how slowly it's going to decay over time. And if we measure how much is here, and we assume we know how much carbon was around 5,000 years ago, we can tell how long. But it makes the assumption, and it's not always wrong by any means, it makes the assumption that we know how much carbon was around and that it was pretty constant. I just want you to know we actually know that's not always true. There are places that you know we can't date in this range, okay? So I'm not telling you that to try to rebut science. I'm telling you that because I don't think people tell you these things. This is based on some assumptions. But radiocarbon dating is probably the best known. Luminescence methods, there are a lot of these. Luminescence methods measure stored electrons in certain minerals. So the idea is that electrons get trapped in some of these minerals. You make some assumptions about the radiation levels 100,000 years ago, and then you measure and you say, well, here's how many are here, and my assumption says there were more then, and I should be able to measure how much time has passed. Again, there are assumptions built into all of this. Luminescence methods can date to maybe 100,000 years ago old. Electron spin resonance are used with carbonates and some sediments. You can date to about 3 million years ago. And electron spin resonance also has assumptions built into it, and it's a little more complicated. It's not particularly worth talking about it in detail. Just know that it also has assumptions in it, and that it can date back to about 3 million years old. And then radiometric methods, and there are a lot of these. This is measuring the decay of certain elements. So potassium argon, for example, is in volcanic rock and volcanic ash, and based on certain assumptions as to how much there was, you measure how much is there now, you know the general decay rate, so you can project back and say, well, this must be this old. This can go back, some would say, billions of years. I would argue millions. It would be more accurate. But other elements, uranium, lead, measuring the radioactive decay of that. So what I want to pass along to you is that dating is a little bit of an art. It's sort of a detective story. There isn't anything particular that's going to take a dinosaur bone and say, I can tell you with absolute certainty that is 201,465,362 years old. I know you get that impression from the press and what you're told. That's not even slightly correct. And scientists will tell you that's not even slightly correct. What you do is you can't actually date a 2-million-year-old bone. So what you do is you figure out where is it found. Maybe I can date some volcanic ash up here, and maybe I can date some volcanic ash down here. And assuming my dating methods, my assumptions are correct, then that'll give me a range, right? That bone is in the middle of these two ash, and this is 50 million years old, and that's 100 million years old. So, must be in there. So, the point I'm trying to make to you is, these sound very technological, and they are, but they are based on assumptions, and they're nowhere near certain. So dating is typically putting together a lot of these things, and none of the dates you get are what any scientist tell you is very, very accurate. Does that make sense? I just want you to be aware that dating anything. Now, to be fair, it does appear that there are things that date to more than 6 to 10,000 years old. And so we'll talk about that. I want to talk about the young or old worth idea. First thing is, the argument here is not so much about whether the science says something's old and young Earth advocates say, I'm sorry, it can't be because of this. The argument is really about what does the Bible want to say. Tim Keller said this, when you refuse to take a biblical author literally, when he clearly wants you to do so, you have moved away from the traditional understanding of biblical authority. So what he's saying, and he's absolutely right, if a text wants to be taken literally and you do not, then you have basically said, I don't believe the Bible is authoritative. So the disagreement among Christians, atheists, they don't care. You know, there's no God anyway, so it doesn't matter. But the disagreement amongst Christians about whether the earth is older or younger is about, it isn't even about the science per se. It's really an argument about, does Genesis want to be taken literally? Because if it does, then we should take it literally. But some will argue it's not intended to be taken that literally. It's intended to tell you things, but it's not intended to tell you that. Does that make sense? So my rule of thumb is hold scientific theories loosely and hold God's word tightly. So I'm not saying to you that you have to necessarily believe the earth is 6 to 10,000 years old. I'm not telling you that that's the only position a Christian could hold. I'm telling you that Christians do hold other positions, but if you're going to do it, it can't be because I'm trying really hard to reconcile it with the science. Because as I mentioned last time, which science? There have been three theories in my lifetime, and there will be more. So hold God's word tightly, hold science loosely, and scientists hold scientific theories loosely because they will change. So young or old earth is really more of a question for Christians about whether what Genesis wants to say. So what would young Earth have to say? I think I'm going to get into this when I talk about creation and evolution. But what would someone who thinks the Earth is 6 to 10,000 years old say about a carbon-14 dated, something that's dated 15,000 years ago? Their point of view would be is that, and this is a legitimate point of view, I'm just going to give you the point, the pros and the cons. The pro is that you can take Genesis literally at its word. The con is you have the problem with how do you reconcile some of this dating. And so the assumption that we're making in this dating is that if God created the earth, it has what the appearance of age. Does that make sense? In other words, we're assuming that God created it all pristine and it actually lived a long time and now it looks old. And so a young earth creationist would say, why do you assume that? In other words, they would say, what if God created it with the appearance of age? Now that may or may not be convincing to you. I just simply want you to know what the answer to that is. So I would, my rule of thumb is scientific theories come and go, embrace them, study them, become good scientists, but hold it loosely. So what I want to get into, so I wanted you to know about the dating, and I wanted you to have a good idea of how would you know something was old? How is this dating done? It's much less certain than you've been told. Nevertheless, you have to give some credence to it. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's move into life, because this stuff all intertwines with the creation of life. This is Genesis days 4 through 6. And so God creates the waters swarm with living creatures. I won't read all this to you. And the birds flying above the earth. And so again, in days 4, 5, and 6, God begins to bring content into the void. He begins to bring meaning into the meaninglessness. And there was evening and there was morning the fourth day, and there was the fifth day. Then on the sixth day, God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, their various kinds, livestock, beasts of the earth, etc. And God created humanity in his own image. He created them male and female. In our next week, we'll talk more about humans. Today, I want to talk about the evolution of creatures. And so he gives them dominion over the earth, and it was the evening and morning, and it was the sixth day. And this is the end of the creation. So you get the universe and order in the first 3 days. You get life and content in the next 3 days. There's no question this is something Genesis wants to say. Does that make sense? Whether or not you agree, Genesis wants to talk about the exact way the earth is created, and it's giving you a theory of the creation of the universe. Everybody agrees. It definitely wants to tell you something about the nature of God and the nature of humanity. The implications of this creation idea are radically different than the implications of an evolutionary idea. So let's move to the evolutionary ideas, because I want to dive into that a little bit. Creation or evolution? Here are the questions. We'll answer a lot of questions, but here are the fundamental questions you have to answer. Was life created according to its kinds? In other words, it doesn't mean everything that's alive today was created by God. That's not exactly what creationism believes. But was life created as it is, so to speak, or did single-celled organisms evolve into complex beings? Evolution does not deal with where the single-cell organisms came from, just like the creation of the universe theories, scientific theories, don't deal with where did the matter come from. Both of them start with it being here already. Evolution has nothing to say about how that first cell came about. It simply says that as you observe life, you realize that life evolves, and this is a theory, life evolves from simple to more complex, and the process is random mutations and natural selection. So the question is, do you believe that evolution, if you believe in evolution, do you believe that it was guided by random mutations and natural selection, which is essential if you make the assumption that there can be nothing super natural. You understand? This is why did Darwin choose these two mechanisms? Because he can't choose a God. He can't choose something outside. He has to work with natural processes. So what are the natural processes at work? Random mutations, they do happen, and natural selection. Natural selection is best known as survival of the fittest. So you have a mutation, and if it helps you survive, then it gets passed on. And if it doesn't, it doesn't get passed on. Everybody with that, everybody's been taught that. There are no evolutionary biologists today that actually believe what you were taught about evolution. And I tell you that because I don't think anybody else is going to tell you that. There are no evolutionary biologists that believe that. So we're going to move on and talk a little bit more about what do evolutionary biologists believe today, and it's going to be surprising. But that's a question. Is evolution guided? Was there some force guiding it? Or did it occur through natural processes of mutation and selection? And then in our next lesson, we'll get to a fundamental idea. Were Adam and Eve real people? You see, if you believe the creationist account, God created Adam and Eve. He created two individual human beings. Evolution, it's hard to even know when a human shows up. Right? Is that a chimpanzee or is that a human? I still have that question occasionally. I don't know about you. But in any case, that's a difficult question to answer. What's even almost impossible to answer is, were there two ancestors? And we'll talk about genetics, and we'll talk about epigenetics and the study of this. So the fundamental question becomes, are natural processes sufficient to explain evolution? So let's talk about this. Creation assumes a God. So I'm going to set that aside for a minute and just say that I will tell you the pros and the con. Creationism says God exists and he created life. Second theory is Darwinian evolution. There is no God. In fact, there's nothing supernatural. And life evolved from simple to complex organisms by random mutations and natural selection. Third idea, these are the four major ideas. You'll find yourself somewhere in here. Intelligent design. There may or may not be a God, but evolution shows signs of intelligent design. Something is tweaking this thing, right? It didn't happen just by random events. So creationism, if you would like to know more about that, I would send you to Answers in Genesis and .org. And you can ask all kinds of questions there, and they will give you the point of view from a creationist point of view. Intelligent design, there are several people doing that, but Discovery Institute is well-known and very some serious scholars there that fundamentally say, yes, I think evolution happened, but there's no way evolution happened unguided, that there has to be intelligent design. And then fourth is theistic evolution. And that is the view that there is a God and he's the one that guided evolution. So what is the difference between this and this? Creationism and theistic evolution both believe that there is a God. Both believe Genesis 1, that God created humanity. Creationism says when you read that account, you should assume that God created Adam and Eve as human beings. Theistic evolution says, well, the science seems to indicate that we evolved, but we reject the random mutations and natural selection, that there's no God here. There's no way this happened. God used the evolutionary process. Does that make sense? So both of those acknowledge a God. One says God used the evolutionary process. The other says no, God created them according to their kinds. These are the four major points of view. Creationism and theistic evolution believe in a God. Intelligent design believes in an intelligent designer. Does not name that being or that force or whatever it may be. So these are the four that I'd like to talk about. So let's talk about first about creationism. I want to talk about the pros and the cons. Creationism is that God, you read Genesis literally, God created the world, God created life, God created humanity exactly the way it says. And the pro to that is you can take the scripture quite literally. The beauty of that is not only would you argue that's true, but here's a more important point for most young people today. Is that good? And the answer is, that is very good, to quote God. In other words, if you were created by a God who loves you, you were created in His image, and you were created with a purpose, that's something that would be very desirable if that were true. Does that make sense? In other words, I want that to be true. Let's just say for a moment, I'm not a Christian. I want that to be true. So that's one of the pros of this. One of the cons of this is you have to deal with certain issues, like what about older sediments that have been found? What about things that don't appear? How do you deal with the idea of the appearance of some kind of evolution? So there are difficulties with this view as well. So you have pros and you have cons. One of the questions, this is just to handle a question. You always have to talk about the dinosaurs. Dinosaurs just sort of fit into this whole thing, but let's talk about dinosaurs. This dinosaur is at the Creation Museum, by the way. A lot of dinosaurs at the Creation Museum. And so how would then this creationist point of view deal with the idea of dinosaurs? Creationists believe dinosaurs existed. Dinosaurs were existed at the same time as human beings. They were created by God. That in Job, the behemoth and Leviathan, the great land animal that's described in Job and the great sea creature that's described in Job, would argue that's dinosaurs living in the time of Job, right? And so that these existed at the same time and that dinosaurs' bones have the appearance of age, that might make a little more sense to you now that you know how things are dated. It's not like you pull it up and go, I can tell you that's exactly 200 million. It's not that simple. It's not that clear. I'm just telling you that their point of view is that these are relatively recent. They simply, the earth has the appearance of age. So pros and cons to that. You have challenges to this idea. You have pro things. Best thing is the idea of a literal, more literal reading of Genesis. So neo-Darwinian evolution. Nobody believes what Darwin proposed. That's clearly incorrect. And I say that not to be critical, that's just clearly incorrect. And so what you see now is what's called neo-Darwinian evolution. Richard Dawkins gives you a little bit of an insight into why evolution is being pushed as hard as it is. Because unless you have a God, you have a really hard time explaining how we got here. And how we got, because if you just look around, you go, okay, this is pretty impressive. I don't know what you think about how we got here, but that deserves an answer. Until evolution, there was no answer that science could embrace. I know that in your and my lifetime, that's hard to imagine, but I want you to go back before the 1860s and Darwin comes up with this idea that, you know what, maybe what you see now wasn't always here. Maybe there were monkeys, and maybe they turn into Homo sapiens through random mutations and natural selection over millions of years, right? So that's a theory that he proposes. Before that time, there is no scientific theory. There is no guess as to how we got here other than somebody created us. Does that make sense? I don't want you to think that this idea has been around forever. It hasn't been around very long at all. And needless to say, if you're an atheist, you're going to grab onto this like it's the last sprinkled donut in the box. I mean, you just clutch that thing. It's like, I need this. I need this theory, which explains to you why this theory is being pushed like a religion. We've gotten beyond science. I'm pro-science. We'll talk a little more about evolution, and we'll talk about some studies in evolution. I think it's fascinating. But this is being pushed as a religion. I mean, it's a faith system, and that's not good science. But the reason is, it's the only game in town besides God. So I understand that. Now, let's talk about evolution, first of all, and no one believes this. This is not the current state of evolutionary biology, is the whole random mutation thing. We'll talk about that. But I do want to differentiate microevolution and macroevolution. And those are terms that are applied to two different phenomenon. One phenomenon that Charles Darwin observed is that it does appear that species change through mutations. So, for example, creatures that live in cold environments have evolved to have thicker fur, thicker hair. He is famous for finches, the beaks on finches on the Galapagos Islands, right? That some of their beaks over a long period of time appeared to have adapted to their environment. Now, when I say adapted, the only mechanism he's got is random mutation. It just happened that one of them was born with a different shaped beak. It worked out really well, and give us 10,000 years, and there are a bunch of them with that shaped beak. Do you understand the process? Okay. So microevolution definitely happens, period. Christian, non-Christian, that is an observable phenomenon, is the idea that within a species that you can see adaptations taking place to an environment. What he theorized from that observation is that the same process would work macroevolution, going from one species to another species. Does that make sense? In other words, instead of, well, some dogs have thick fur, and they've developed that way over time, and some dogs are small, and some dogs are this, and you know, you get the whole idea of genetics, and you get the idea of mutations, and what's best adapted for the environment, and over thousands and thousands of years, you see this variety. That just makes so much sense. That's microevolution, evolution within a species. He said, you know what, I wonder if that same mechanism could turn a dog into something more complex. I don't know what's more complex than a dog, probably a cat. I mean, they're just emotionally complex creatures, right? But you get my point, is that maybe we take a chimpanzee and you could turn it actually into a human being. I'm shorthanding this, but do you see what I'm saying? He theorized, he didn't observe, he theorized that the same mechanism could work between species. You could get a new species from one that was older. Macroevolution. Macroevolution, extremely problematic. Darwin, as a good scientist, the way you do theories is, he said, I've observed this micro changes, and I'm going to theorize that macro changes, and I'm going to be famous, because if that's the case, I can get you human beings without a god. And Richard Dawkins, cheers. But the point is, he makes predictions, which is what theories do. If you've got a theory, he says, well, if my theory is correct, you should see this and you should see that happen, right? You should find in the fossil record, for example, something in between a chimpanzee and a human. You should see something in between a sea creature and a land animal that kind of was the missing link, you know, the intermediate stages. He also theorized that you should see gradual changes over time. Since the processes are random, it's random mutations, you don't know when a change is going to happen, then that should be happening just sort of gradually over millions of years. So he makes several predictions, and herein lies some of the downside. So the positive thing is microevolution is true, and it does provide a theory that gets rid of God. Positive thing for people that believe that. So what are the difficulties, though? First is the fossil record is not gradual. If you look at the fossil record of development of what you dig up, you realize it's not a gradual process like Darwin thought it would be, like he predicted it would be if his theory was true. In fact, what you have are long periods in the fossil record where nothing happens. It's like a little town on a Saturday night. It's dead. And then all of a sudden, an explosion of new life forms show up in the fossil record. And so you get, and so the theory changes, and it's called punctuated equilibrium. That Darwin was, he was right about everything else, but he was wrong about the gradual part. And so it takes it in leaps and bounds. Nothing in the theory that would explain that, but fundamentally, this is one of the problems, is the unexpected fossil record. Second, as anybody who studies genetics will tell you, anything historical, almost all mutations are harmful or lethal. Mutations are not normally, I mean, not even slightly normally, advantageous. So Darwin's theory is that you're going to get random mutations, and there'll be enough mutations that some of them are going to be very positive. They're going to be reinforced by natural selection, and then over many generations of breeding, it becomes the norm. The problem with it is that as the more you learn about genetics, the more we study that, the more we realize, boy, that's less frequent than Darwin had hoped it would be, is that mutations are very rarely advantageous. It's not a deal killer, just not good news for Darwin. Irreducible complexity. This is the intelligent design idea that says we like evolution too, but we don't like blind evolution. We don't like random, because there are certain things, probably the most famous is, I think Michael Behe's probably the one that talked about this, is the eye, the human eye. Problem is, Darwin says if you want to get a new structure, like you have creatures that don't have eyes, and now they do have eyes, and you have creatures that have simple eyes, and now you have us that have really good eyes, right? The problem is you have to get there by accident through many mutations. Problem with an organ like the eye, for example, you got to get it all at once. Because the problem is, if you get a mutation that gets you part of the way to having an eye, why does that get passed on through the population? It doesn't help you survive. It doesn't do anything with survival of the fittest. You actually need about 10 mutations all at once to get an eye. Now, I would agree with you. If you got an eye and nobody else does, that is a survival trait. The problem is you can't get an eye by just little sequences. Does that make sense? This is not a complex idea, but it's a powerful idea. It's very difficult to argue. How do you get to organs that can't be built up one piece at a time? And here's what makes it even worse. So I hope I don't lose you on this. But with random mutations and natural selection, and with evolution, you don't get to save up mutations. So it's like, well, I've got a creature and it's got a mutation that's 1/5 of what I need for an eye. Okay, hold on to that. Now we're going to mutate that creature to get the next one. Whoa, 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 back the bus up. This is Darwinian evolution. You don't get to save things up. Every mutation has to be an advantage to survive. Does that make sense? That's why this is such a powerful argument from the intelligent design people. They're like, man, this looks like this is designed, because I don't think you can get there in these little steps. The rise of complexity in organisms in general. Why evolution and not devolution? Does that sound like a trivial question? That's an extremely difficult question to answer. We have been taught to think that, you probably say, if I say things evolved, what do you naturally think of? They got bigger, better, smarter, more complicated. They started out simple and they got complicated. You think that's evolution. That's not evolution. That's not even slightly part of Darwin's theory. Nothing in his theory says things need to go from simple to complex. Do you understand that? There's nothing in that theory that says that, and yet they do. That is a problem. The rise of complexity in organisms is not something that you can get from Darwinian theory. So what you get, so I'm just telling you the pros and the cons of this. The pros are you don't need a god, and you do have microevolution. Cons are massive problems to get all the way from single-celled organisms to a human being, or anything else for that matter. A lot of problems. I'll give you a quote from an evolutionary biologist. I'm going to give you more next time when we get to human beings, but he says, within mainstream evolutionary biology, there are debates about this increasing complexity And could that actually arise from natural selection or even natural processes? Actually, we think it begins to arise from, listen to this phrase, self-organizing properties of biological systems. That is scientific language for, and then I waved my wand and I got a human being. That's literally self-organizing principles of biological systems. We'll talk more about this next week, and I'll quote a few studies for you. But the interesting thing is that evolutionary biology, not everybody, is really moving away from Darwinian evolution because they don't want to go intelligent design, but the recognition is, you're right. The theory doesn't seem to explain how you get this much complexity. Does that make sense? There's got to be another mechanism at work. So I'll stop there for the time being because I just wanted you to see some of the pros and some of the cons. So, questions.
How do young Earth believers suggest that dinosaurs became extinct?
Dinosaurs became extinct. They were slow, could not get on the ark. Typically, I'm joking. That was a joke. That was a cheap shot. Christian humor there. Most young Earth view is that dinosaurs were on the ark. I'm not talking a brontosaur. I mean, you think this through a little bit. This is not as crazy as you sound at first. But the different kinds of dinosaurs, and there weren't that many kinds of dinosaurs, were on the ark, and they later went extinct, very possibly from a cataclysmic event or a climate-type event. So typically, some think they perished in the flood, some think they were on the ark. They're just slightly different points of view, but that they did indeed perish, perhaps from some of the same reasons other people think they perished.
So do you have a view on how the flood may have impacted the earth, fossil, land, plants, etc., and whether or not this event is likely to have caused confusion in our scientific understanding today?
Yes. When we get to the flood, which we'll do in this series, when we get to a few chapters on in Genesis, and I'll save that, but it's good to mention that a young earth point of view says that the earth has the appearance of age. They would argue that scientific dating is a lot of assumptions, and what if those assumptions aren't right? I will say this, it is true that most of the dating is based on a lot of factors, and if one or two assumptions turn out to be not true, that whole thing comes tumbling down. But good science says, okay, well, we need another theory. Again, that's not an argument against science. That's just saying that's the way science works. And some of these assumptions will not be true. Fundamentally, what the argument is how do you know that this flood did not alter some of your assumptions? And it did not change conditions so that your assumptions are not correct. That's the way I would characterize it. That's a valid point. So that would be the answer that you would use is that the flood, in the terms that I've been explaining to you, it changed some of the assumptions. I've already told you that carbon dating has a few holes in it because there are certain times that we know the assumptions don't work there. Great, if you know that, you account for it. But it's interesting that there are times when the assumptions don't work. That would be this argument, is it changed your assumptions and they're no longer correct.
Okay, I have a couple of questions dealing with interdimensional beings or UAPs, an unidentified aerial phenomenon. We're having lots of discussion about that within the government and other people. So does Genesis give us any insight into those things?
It's a good question. I want to make one observation for you. This is how weird things have been the last 6-7 years. I don't know if you remember this, but the government finally admitted that there are such things as unidentified flying objects, meaning that they have observed that they can't explain. Remember back in the 60s, got the people in Roswell, government says, weather balloons, you know, and all these things. The government finally admits it. We've been lying all along. We know there are unidentified objects, and nobody even noticed because it was COVID. Brilliant move on their part. I know. Let's admit it during COVID. It'll get totally washed out of the news, and it did. So somebody's realized, yes, the government has said that. So the question is, does Genesis contemplate that? It neither contemplates it nor denies it. In other words, it's very neutral on that. There's nothing in the Genesis account that said, by the way, God made little green men and women on another planet. Nor is there anything in Genesis that said God could not have made something else. So I'm not trying to give you a crazy theory here. I'm just saying Genesis does not speak to that issue. I think, though, multiverse is rife for this. If you have a multiverse and you have a lot of universes, you could have all different kinds of creatures in all these universes. And one of the multiverse ideas is that one universe can tunnel into another universe. This is a science fiction writer's dream, you know, and so I think multiverse is going to have to deal with that. But Genesis, in all seriousness, Genesis simply does not address that question.
Light and dark, day and night, were created on the first day, but the sun, the moon, the stars were not created until the fourth day, creating what we know of today as light and dark 24-hour days, gravity, all the things that are provided. So is it a fair assumption that 24-hour days may not have been in play until that time?
Great question. Two ideas here. One is that if you think that the Earth is old, the universe is old. I keep saying Earth. The universe is old, but that there is a God. One of the ways you would argue to read Genesis, you would say 24-hour days don't start till day four. So what could these days be? And so typically Christians who think the universe is old and think God made it, but they usually think God just started the Big Bang. Don't know what we're going to have to think about the multiverse. We got to come up with another plan. But that God started the Big Bang and let it go. The issue there is two, is called the day-age view, which is each day was not a 24-hour day. They're not arguing with Genesis. They're just saying maybe it wasn't a 24-hour day. Maybe it was many millions of years. And that speaking is in these periods of time. So that would be the point. The second point of view is these are God's days. In other words, God divided creation into six pieces and spoke to us, because what do we know? Evening and morning and a day. We know days. And he spoke that way, but it was really God's time. And God's time, God's outside of time. And so it wasn't 6 to 10,000 years. Could have been 2 billion years. Could have been 100 billion years. So that's that, and that's why some Christians would argue that perhaps it's not 6 to 10,000 years. Perhaps it's longer. But still affirm Genesis as being true. Does that make sense? But that would be one of the arguments for that and how you would do that. Okay, so we're going to stop here, and I want to continue with evolution a little. I want to let you digest that a little bit, and then I want to get into some of the deeper questions about particularly human beings. And I would like to talk about what do evolutionary biologists today, if Darwin's mechanisms are not sufficient to give you human beings? I want to focus on humans next time. That they would argue are not complicated enough to give you cats either. But let's just focus on the humans for a minute. They would say, well, those mechanisms are not robust enough, but we don't want to be intelligent design, and heaven's sakes, we don't want to be Christians. So how are we going to explain this? And I want to talk to you about where is evolutionary biology today trying to figure out how you get this complexity? And then I also want to talk about the idea of, was there an Adam and was there an actual Eve? Because those are litmus test points for Christians and atheists. So next time, we'll dive back into evolution a little. Now that you know these are the basics of evolution, let's go a little farther and let's see where would evolution today. Again, what you were taught in your textbooks, what's being taught in textbooks today, is not widely believed by evolutionary biologists. So let's catch up with the science a little bit and see what the current thinking is. I think it'll surprise you a little bit. So that's what we'll do next time. Thank you, guys.